So folks, just in terms of your playground voice, I do quite a bit of interaction, so I'm expecting you to be talking almost as much as I. And so do please practice that playground voice. All of you will also be asked to do some writing in this session. So I'm going, we have one-sided sheets that should be enough. I'll just ask you to pass them around, and I may make some of these into paper airplanes and throw them up to you. Oh no, and there are all kinds of pens. There are pens here and pens here. There. And here.
Some pens back this way.
Oh, this is just random.
Yes, yeah, so we can write on.
And here's some sheets to pass around, I think. Well, thanks for coming. Just a few introductory words. My name is Hal, and it's a great pleasure to be with you all. I think the kind of studying that we're going to be doing at 9 o'clock in the morning is really, it really has at least as much to do with spiritual practice. So I'm actively working on each day taking one or two Gospels to basically try to experience the Gospels, not as if this is the experience that one might have in the first century, but the experience that you might have by being inside the Gospel itself. So, because the Gospels are generally so large, we could do this for each Gospel for a month. But we're going to have six or seven Gospels in the mix throughout the week. One other thing to say is we will have a bit of study. I'll try to provide you with some information about the first two centuries in which all of this material has been written. But you do need to know, and some of you have heard this before from me, that being a historian of the first two centuries of the Common Era is a fairly tall order. So I have been at it for some 40 years. Many of you know that I'm retired. I've always been both a professor and a pastor. But being a historian of almost 2,000 years ago is more or less impossible. In other words, just think about something that might be 2,000 years ago, almost on the other side of the world, and through all kinds of other cultures. So, I was taught in my early days in New Testament and early Christian studies. I was taught to say things like, "We know this is the case about the first century." And what I would encourage you to do is just say to yourself, "Hal is probably lying." Because really, it's a pretense to say that one can know that much about such a far off and far distant place. And so I am good at guessing with 40 years of knowledge, but that's often all I'm doing. And I really beg you to challenge when we get those kind of chances. And and to hopefully be somewhat forgiving with the way that I was taught, which was to act as if I know everything. So today we are, we're going to look at really two Gospels, one inside the canon and one outside the canon. And we're going to look at how they are actually very much, I would say, in the same family of texts, in the same early Christ movement family of thinking and being spiritual. And so we'll look at one at a time, and midway through,
what else should we have?
Nothing like that.
Okay. These two?
Yeah, we should have a one sheet on both sides, the Gospel of John. And, yes. So, the introduction to, yes.
Okay,
good.
Okay.
Oh, thank you.
Who all needs the Gospel of John? There's one, okay, one, two, three, four, right?
So by the Gospel of John, actually...
Yeah, under perfect mind.
We have two handouts. One is a one page, and it's text from both the Gospel of John and the Thunder Perfect Mind. And then the other is a four-page sheet that with information for both.
Okay.
So this is the worksheet that we'll be working with. The other is a take-home to think about.
So
there's a one-page and a two-page, or if you count both sides, a two-page and a four-page. And then there's also, yes, oh, that's right. That's what Elaine was showing me. If you have something with a bill from Holden or something from another course of mine, that's actually meant to be written on the other side.
Okay.
Oh,
scratch paper, yeah.
Scratch.
All right.
Okay.
So who still needs the four sheets? One, two, three.
I have an extra.
Okay. And then there's a hand.
Great.
Up.
Okay.
Okay. You could just sail that down. All right. So.
A single sheet.
Oh, thank you.
This
one goes back to Stacy.
Thank you. You have the
single sheet. She's got the single. Oh, thank you. No, that's your spot. What a tough problem to have. Too much thinking and too much having fun at the same moment. Thanks.
I'll go make 10 more single sheets and then let Hal talk. Thank you.
So I want us to talk in both of these cases about the first person singular in these two texts. And some of you know that Jesus talks really different in the Gospel of John than the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, by and large, Jesus hardly ever talks about himself. He mostly talks about parables, tells parables and little aphorisms about the world and a little bit about God and a lot about other people. That's Matthew, Mark, and Luke. In John, Jesus basically only talks about himself. And that's the one we're looking at today. So there's a lot of I this, I that in the Gospel of John where Jesus speaks in the first person singular. And we won't be really thinking too much about how this is different than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. I just want us to deep dive into John and to put John in perspective with a text that's quite similar. So Jesus will go, will take several chapters just to talk mostly about his relationship to God and to people. On one of your handouts, I'll refer to in just a moment, to look at all of the I am statements in John. It turns out, you'll see, about 20 times Jesus says the words I am in ways that are very special and different, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But I want to give just a little bit of an overview of Jesus and when he says I am, who he's mostly talking about. The first thing to say is that Jesus talks a lot about I am very tight with God the Father. I know everything God the Father knows, and the God the Father knows everything I know. We do a lot together. We talk a lot together. You kind of remember that view of the Gospel of John. So Jesus is either talking to God the Father or, excuse my rusty throat there, about him. And there I more or less have to use the him with advisement. So a couple of places Jesus kind of puts an overview on this. And there he talks about who he is in relationship to people and to God. And this is repeated a number of times in the gospel, and it says, he says to people, I am in the Father, and the Father's in me, and I am in you, and you are in me. So, basically, when Christian orthodoxy got to thinking about the Gospel of John, it sort of thought that the big thing was Jesus' tight relationship with God the Father. But what it turns out is that that is actually just alongside of Jesus being as close to people. So I am in you, and you are in me, he says to people, and he says the same thing to God the Father. another thing that's really interesting is that twice in chapter 14, Jesus talks about what happens after Jesus leaves. And there he says two really interesting things that I think most of us disregard, but I would call into attention here. One is that in 14:12, Jesus says, when I leave, you're going to do more than I do. So notice how that's related to I am in you and you're in me, right? In other words, actually, despite Christian doctrine that this is all about Jesus being better than us, this is mostly about Jesus and humans being intimately the same. And then in 14:26, Jesus says, well, when I leave, actually, there's going to be another presence there, sometimes called the helper, sometimes called the advocate. Actually, that person will also teach me everything, teach you everything you need to know. That's a very quick overview of us thinking about Jesus and Jesus's who Jesus thinks Jesus is. I'm going to add then one thing as we go into these I am sayings. And if you all can't see this screen, please. This is a Greek word. Ego et me. Some of you can see it, right? And so this is the Greek word for I am. Oh, again, Hal's wrong. This is actually a special kind of I am, in that if you're saying I am in Greek, as in many other languages, you only use one word. So, a me is the word for I am. You don't have two words, you just have one word. So, if it says, I am a vanilla malt maniac, that would be just a me, because I am. But if you put ego, and you notice you kind of understand the word ego, right? Ego? It is another, it's like I with a big I. So this, you really translate this, and these are all of this, these two words are used every time Jesus says, I am. So he really says, I myself am. Or, I really am. So that's a super, oh, thank you. This never happened.
Al, quick
question. Yes, Ron.
Does this have any relationship to God's announcement to Moses?
Yes, this is almost certainly a sign of the divine I am. Ego et me, not only in the Bible but beyond, is a divine speech. Now you can find it about regular people, but not often. It's mostly, it's what gods say, or goddesses say. Across the Greek language, ego et me is a super I am. So now, watch how now what I've proposed so far is already complicated. So I have suggested that when Jesus talks about who he is in relationship to humans, he assumes a very tight intimacy, both with God and with people, in not a descending order. But the intimacy and I am-ness is shared both by people and God the Father. I think it's time for a question or two or a thought or a protest. Okay, we'll start waving your hand. Oh, good.
Yes, so it's about connection. It's about connection of something that was previously believed to be disconnected. Is my understanding?
Except for that last clause, I think yes. In other words, I don't think this is necessarily different than other cultures, other religions, and earlier have thought. But this is this way of saying yes. Interconnected intensely with God and interconnected intensely with people. In an intimacy that, as Jesus says, I am in you, and you are in me. I am in God the Father, and he in me. So, yeah, that is a perfect summary. Yes, and I've forgotten your name.
Angelia. Wouldn't that bring out the significance of relationship, like our relationship with God and his with us, and the importance of relationship?
Yeah, no, that's exactly, I think, and think intimate and think intense.
I think of the sermon last night out of Job, the visual of the swaddling and you know, the hush. I mean, that really resonated with me,
yeah,
how personal me it is.
Yeah, personal. Absolutely. Yes.
So the word I am in you and you are in me.
Right.
That you part, is it related to a specific?
Yeah.
Who is Jesus talking to, specific Jewish community or you who?
Yeah, so, by and large, this is, your question is beyond my pay grade. But let me guess. So my sense is that all writing that we have eventually in the Bible or not, but from the early Christ movements, all of it is to specific people. It's just that because we put this stuff in the Bible or didn't, we think it's to all of us. But I think historically, I would have to say, therefore, this you, in the thought of the authors of this time, probably mean a specific general group of people in a certain place in a certain time, or a lot of people say that John is only talking to John's community. That's my best guess, and I may contradict myself any moment now.
I would just like to add that, because I see this a lot. A lot of people read the you meaning me, but it's not. It's always in connection with others, like John's beloved community, or some, anyway, you plural. It's always you plural.
Yeah, thank you. That's very, very important. And the way I just say it is Southern. That is,
you all.
It's all y'all. Basically, hardly ever in early Christ movement literature do you find the single you. But there are two different words. And we have two different words for the single you and the plural you. It's almost always the plural, as is everything in John. So when Jesus says, I'm in you and you're in me, is I'm you and you're in me. Very helpful material. Okay, let's just take a look at the I ams in John, and I have that on on your first single sheet. And what I want to do is just very briefly, and I'd love if you want to take this home kind of and do spiritual exercise with it. I think there are three categories of I ams, of ego me's. That are relevant here. One is that Jesus associates himself with very common things, like bread, like sheep, like branches. So there you have an I am that is, in many cases, I'm the door. I'm the door for sheep. I mean, you don't get much more common than the door for sheep, right? These kind of I ams are all about Jesus associating who he is with just common stuff. This is very different than much of the way a great I am is spoken in other settings, anciently or modernly. Usually it's, I'm really special, right? This is, I'm just bread and door. Well, it's not just I am, because in fact, there are some others that make Jesus's I ams, as you look on that page, relatively special. So, for instance, you find, I will tell you of things before they take place, so that when they take place, you may trust that I am. Notice that last I am is the ego me. So that doesn't sound like ordinary bread and doors. That sounds like relatively special. Then you have... I encourage you in this text, as in all, to assume that there are double and triple meanings almost everywhere. That this stuff is written, I say to my students, like Shakespeare. In other words, expect every sentence to have three meanings built into it and connected to other things. So here, for instance, if you would look on your list about five down, where it says, when you have lifted up the child of humanity, then you will understand that I am. Now this is a code word in the Gospel of John. For, so if you, when you're lifted up, that means it says, when you have lifted up the child of humanity is a word for Jesus in the third person. When you have lifted up the child of humanity, in Gospel of John talk, this means when Jesus is crucified. Lifted up is always a word that says Jesus is being lifted up. Now notice, again, the double and triple meaning. So by and large, lifted up is an honoring, right? In John, it is both an honoring and a torture. So that's built into the I am, into the lifted up. But so here, Jesus says, it's when you have lifted up, when you have started torturing the child of humanity, then you will understand that I am. Or might, you will understand who I am. So by the way, there is basically no atonement theory in the Gospel of John. So this is about the act of being killed violently. So you really, really understand Jesus when you know that he's been tortured to death. Similarly, we've got another amazing thing that I just love, a little bit down from there. This is where Jesus has healed a man in the from blindness. So afterwards, people are talking about the man, and you see in parentheses, they ask when the man healed from blindness, and they ask if he used to sit and beg. And yes, somebody said, yeah, he's the beggar that just got healed. And other people say, no, he looks like him, but he's not. Now, this is a really cool double, triple meaning in John. Then the man himself says, guess what the man says? I myself am. He uses the word for God for himself. On the other hand, you would want to say, he's just saying, yeah, it's me. But this is so typical of the care this literature takes of giving in-depth meaning. So in other words, somebody just saying, yeah, it's me. When you look carefully at the Greek, it's also, yes, me, and you better think of me like you think of Jesus and God.
Al?
Yes?
So you just introduced a problem. How are we to understand the statement?
I think the same way as the overarching strategy. I am in you, and you are in me, and I am the Father, and the Father is in me. Therefore, that's a bundle.
Because I can see people criticizing that statement as blasphemy, right?
Well, that's one of the common insults to Jesus in the Gospel of John, is you're blaspheming. Yeah, that's right. And again, I would encourage you to protest on this. This is, you're right, we're getting out on an edge of what I think is just at the heart of John. But Christian doctrine says John is only about saying how great Jesus is. I want to say John is about Jesus' greatness in us and our greatness in John, and therefore our greatness in God and God's greatness in us. Okay, yes?
I was going to ask this question earlier. I mean, just bring it up.
sharing in the divinity.
Absolutely. I mean, how do you say God, I and the Father are in one another, and I and you are in one another, without getting there really quickly? And how do you identify yourself with a person just healed with a door and bread, without saying this is divine intimacy with not just people, but mostly people, but also doors. Doors for Gene. I'm going to stop here and just wait and see if there's someone puzzling. Yes.
So I really am claim you.
Yeah.
Does that make the you, you really are? And the reason I ask this is this morning the sermon was like how you see God really shape the way you look at the world. If you look at God as the way He is, mm-hmm. then that makes me the great we are, so we can conquer. So how is that relationship could be filtered?
Yeah, wonderful question. Just in the Greek, actually, the Greek leaves out the verb to be in most cases, so it's just you great, or you vine. It's not, I think it's the identification into the great I am rather than the great you are. Now, just to say that we're sticking closely to the Gospel of John, if we were asking this about the Gospel of Matthew, I would have given you a different answer.
Yeah.
Let's look at the thunder line. Yes, go ahead.
If I can just throw in, at least for me personally, what we're focused on in John's Gospel and this kind of sounding fairly spiritual Jesus, walking a couple inches above the ground, you know, and in such intimacy with God the Father, and now, as you mentioned, of course, also with us. But what helps me keep grounded is some of the stories, like when he weeps.
Mm-hmm.
See, now, okay, now I can relate a little better to that Jesus. Or, of course, I think the ultimate one near the end of the gospel is when he shows up again with wounds. That's who he is.
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you very much. That's part of this cross-breeding of humanity and divinity. Because we Protestants, I hope there are some people who aren't Protestant in the room, so excuse me. Because we mostly Protestants don't know how to be intimate with God, I'm pressing today to claim this part of John. And so by the end of the time, you will be writing about how you and God are one. I do want to, however, take a few moments at one of the most famous discoveries of the last century and a half. Actually, this is just in the last 60 years. Something found in the jar in the desert with 52 other early Christ movement documents. So many of you may know the Nag Hammadi discovery in Egypt. We'll be talking about that throughout. But one of those texts was the Thunder Perfect Mind. And I've given you the long version and the short version of the Thunder Perfect Mind. I only want you to look at the short version. And just to say that this is a great I am. This is a divine person speaking from the divine self. So here it's often helpful for people to just read this out loud together. So I'm going to ask you to turn around and the Thunder Perfect Mind, and we'll just let anyone read a line, and then another person will. Not in an order, but just if you want, when you want. So I'll read the first one, and then we'll read it down one by one, and read it loud. I was sent forth from power.
I came to those pondering me, and I found among those seeking me.
Look at me, all you who contemplate me.
Eyes, hear me.
Two together, by the way, sounds kind of musical. Yeah. Oh, that's good. Right?
Those expecting me, receive me.
Don't chase me from your sight. Don't let your voice or your hearing hate me.
Don't ignore me any place, any time. Be careful. Do not ignore me.
Oh, now, some of you are reading the long version. This is on the back of the short version.
The
Thunder Perfect Mind, though, this is the short version because we'd be here until 11.
I am the first and the last.
Okay, everybody got their short version? Okay.
Yep.
All right.
I am she who is honored and she who is mocked.
I am the whore and the holy woman.
I am he, the mother, and the daughter.
I am the limbs of my mother.
I am a sterile woman and she has many children.
I am the she whose wedding is extravagant and I didn't have a husband.
I am the silence never found.
And the idea infinitely recalled.
I am without shame.
I am ashamed.
I am she who is disgraced and she who is important.
Do not stare at me when I'm thrown out among the condemned.
Do not laugh at me in the lowest places.
Do not throw me down among those slaughtered viciously.
In my weakness, do not strip me bare.
Do not be afraid of my power.
I am she who exists in all fears and in trembling boldness.
I am a barbarian among barbarians.
All right, so just for you to know that this is one of the most famous documents from this, what I call an early Jesus jar, with 51 other documents about Jesus. And what I want to just suggest as it being a companion to the Gospel of John is, first of all, of course, the I am-ness. And notice that it even quotes from the Revelation of John, I am the first and the last. Different John, by the way. This is also hauntingly like John, in that, as we said just before, John's Jesus is tortured to death. John's death, Jesus has wounds. What do you notice about this in that regard? This is an I am person who it has been thrown to the ground viciously, has been attacked, and has power. Or as it says, puts that all together, I am she who exists in all fears and in trembling boldness. Another thing you may want to know about the Gospel of John, especially with this gender bendedness, right? Mm-hmm. So this I am is mostly female. Mm-hmm. Not altogether, that I am he, the mother, is in the Coptic. This is all in Coptic. And therefore is somewhat gender-bended. There are 23 places where this I am refers to itself as female, and 5 places where it refers to itself as male. Interesting inversion to what we're used to. But here you have, like John, This is a tortured deity. This is also, like John, a deity, a divinity that is right in the midst. Like the door handle, like the bread, like the man healed of blindness. This has got a lot of interest in the divine and the human, the pain and the joy of being very close to one another. When I teach thunder, I just want to acknowledge that you all have a lot of questions. I want you to actually just get to what I would call praying or meditating on John and this. So I'm going to first have us just take 10 minutes to do the following. Would you consider, please, to write us, sit and write for a few minutes in the following way. Write down who you are. I am, I am, I am. Consider two things. Consider that you might write down how you are divine. You don't have to say those words directly if you're nervous about it, although that's what Jesus and John want you to do. But just really say, now who are you? But allow yourself to think that you are a part of divine power and love, and to phrase it that way. Similarly, allow yourself to be contradictory. Allow yourself to consider the painful parts of you that may just rub up very closely with the joyful and powerful parts of you. So allow your own I am to be like these two I am. An embrace of divinity and a description of yourself as contradictory, hurt, and devoted. If you only come with two or three sentences you can, often people will be really let go and be able to write down a number of things. And if you can't find any, then don't write anything. There's a chance that I'll ask some people to read what they wrote out loud, if we have time, but I won't force you to write anything, because I hope some of what you write is intimate, that no one should hear. I'll call you back. Anybody need paper? Pens? Well, I'm just wanting to raise the possibility that you might take this spiritual exercise with these texts a bit further. During the week, if this seems helpful, or I would say if it feels offensive, both of those would be reasons to keep doing it. I've found taking a pen and paper and taking a walk in these surroundings really an interesting way to do what I call this kind of prayer. And just to say that for me, I've experienced that thinking that prayer always begins with "Dear God" and ends with "Amen" actually doesn't necessarily give us all the options we have in becoming in God and God in us. So here, here one might have that possibility. But really, if you do know that this isn't for you, that would be probably one short of being insulted. That would just be clear thinking. Please follow that advice. But if it's troubling you, you might want to try it a little bit further. You see, often what troubles us ends up helping us. And what I would want to do, suggest is that looking at the complex and multi-leveledness of these two ancient Christian texts may also help you notice something else. So, for instance, just that amazing thing about Jesus and John being lifted up, being honored and made powerful at the same time as being tortured. That is inherent in the way I think John is leading us. Another thing to then just say is, so if you're not interested in considering these ancient gospels as ways of deepening spiritually, it's understandable. In other words, a lot of folks are finding a lot of spiritual renewal by going to the 21st century. This week, basically, we're going to continue to do a spiritual exercise with a different gospel or two each day. What is frustrating to me is how alive you all have been in the discussion. And we haven't had enough time. So this is only the second of the 10 times I've been here in which I've decided that at least a third of this session should be spiritual deepening, not intellectual deepening. So just to let you know, that's what I'm toying with, and I know I and others have been responsible for pushing everyone only intellectually, and I think that's a mistake. Mm-hmm. We've got 5 more minutes. Let's just have comments, protests, questions as we begin the week together. Yes?
The thunder, we have a short version. Is there something specifically about Jesus, or do they just assume it's part of that because it's in that jar?
Yeah, that is the question. We're pretty sure that jar was assembled in the 3rd century by a monastery in central Egypt. But there is one, we know there's one non-Christian writing of those 52, and that's Plato's Republic. So it's possible that this was not used as a kind of prayer for the monks, as this came down from earlier times. The combination of how important it is to know about Jesus's pain and loss, as well as his power and healing, is pretty easy to see. Even if the monks were taking it from someplace else, they were thinking about it with Jesus themselves. I only know in the ancient world of 2 texts that show a divine character being tortured, and that's these 2. But I think that's pushing it to say that your question is answered.
Where does title Perfect Thunder come from?
Well, yeah, so here's the fraud that all of us are about. So the ancients don't care about titles at all. In and outside the Bible, we know that, for instance, the Gospel of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all of the earliest manuscripts don't have a title on them. And Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John don't exist in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We're almost positive that almost all titles come from the scribal people who are copying and copying and copying, because they're trying to keep the different copy projects apart. That's a facile way of saying, I don't know. The word thunder doesn't occur in the text at all. And by the way, look at the longer text if you get a chance, so you have it in hand. The word mind does, but not in relationship to this. So, yet another way I feel. I don't know. But I don't know why the Gospel of Mark is called the Gospel of Mark.
You had mentioned that most likely the author was writing to a particular audience.
Mostly, you know, yeah. I think so.
And I'm curious about that, because this is so intimate, talks about so much interconnectedness. Was that part of the Jewish mindset, or is this kind of whole new concept to Jewish?
Are you talking about both these texts or one particular, or Thunder or
it can
John?
Be both.
Yeah, no, I think that these are generally the intimacy you'll find throughout the ancient world, and the challenge to thinking straight or feeling straight, or feeling crooked for that matter. Is pretty common, but this is high level. This is high level composition that really takes seriously deep problems. So for me, I would want to say we've only recently, in our study of the scriptures, noticed that it's happening during. A time when the Roman Empire has crucified not one person, not three persons, but 300,000 persons. I mean, almost every person in Israel has had a family member crucified, and even broader. So that both of these texts are really interested in sneaking up on or addressing the massive violence in their lives is, for me, that's just showing that in a whole bunch of different places, life was so raw that you had to write about it, and the telling stories about Jesus was one primary way to do that, mainly because in the larger public, the thing he was known most for was being tortured to death, and that he shared with hundreds of thousands of other people. So, in other words, his crucifixion is not an exception; it's the rule. So, I hope I'm close to your question. It's one after. I'm like a time Nazi. I always stop on time. And I hang around here, folks. Come and talk.